Sometimes you need someone to be around you, someone to sit down and pour your shochu. But sometimes saying goodbye to familiar folks is the only way. Sometimes that's when you finally find your space.
Hello and welcome to the Japan Distilled Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Lyman, recording in my home studio in Fukuoka, Japan. And with me today from Australia is Hamish Nugent, a chef and distiller. And we'll learn much more about him and the Reed & Company Distillery in today's conversation. Hamish, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan, and thank you for spreading the word so well. I've been sharing your podcast with everyone that wants to listen, as the educational pieces have been amazing.
Great. Thank you so much for those kind words. It's always an honor to hear that from distillers, from people who do this professionally, that they're listening to the show and getting something out of it, because sometimes we're not sure if what we're doing is actually useful. I've worked in distilleries, but I've never been a professional distiller. Certainly have spent a lot of time in distilleries at this point. But you didn't start as a distiller, right? You started as a chef.
So to go all the way back to the start, I was a school dropout, found my life in the kitchen, very rewarding, and then followed that career through, and that took me all around the world, which has been an amazing experience. And at the age of 23, I became a restaurateur and have been ever since with my partner, Rachel Reed. And that's where our true love for Japan kind of started. The ethos, the flavors, and the techniques really drew us into the whole philosophy. And here we are today.
So you were a restaurateur at 23. I usually hear I became a restaurateur at 33 or that sort of thing. But you clearly got a lot of experience early on and were able to turn that into a business.
I suppose that was one of the advantages of starting the kitchen at such a young age. It gave me the experience that I needed, and also having great mentors as well in the industry, like Michael Ryan from Providence Restaurant in Beechworth, who's quite well regarded and renowned in Australia. He also introduced me to a lot of the Japanese styles as well. So from there, Rachel and I opened multiple restaurants, from our first restaurant, Subo. Probably Tani Dining was the main one, which has placed us where we are today. So we had a lab associated to the restaurant, which where we did all of our R&D work to kind of create new flavors. And part of that was experimenting with distillation, different temperatures of distillation, from vacuum distillation to atmospheric distillation. We then became fascinated about spirits, to take that to the next step, and we became a licensed distillery and did our first release in 2016. And then from there, because we had such a love affair with Japan, we obviously were using koji from a early on stage, but very much for food production, not so much for alcohol production. And I think that was the big learning curve, where we were so naive. We thought we could just take what we'd learned in the lab, what we're using in the restaurant, and just pivot that straight across into the spirit world. We were humbled very quickly. We then set out on a journey which has taken roughly 6 years to where we are now, of, I don't want to say the word mastering koji, but trying to get the fundamentals of the koji exactly right. Because as we know, if we don't get that first step right, the end product's not going to be enjoyable. So we spent a lot of time teaching ourselves, educating ourselves, and learning about koji. And then we're humbled very quickly again once we'd realized that, okay, we have a product that we want to use. We've worked out that we can do this in micro batches of fermentation, but we need to scale. And we thought we could use our existing distillery to scale in, and we're completely wrong. So we had a 1,000-liter offset 10-column still, a burn still that's made here in Australia in New South Wales. We had a 180-litre copper still that was made in Czech, and a 50-litre rotovat. We were destroying the copper stills. With a pH level of 2.5, we're literally stripping the copper out of the stills. So we realised to get to this next step and to scale, we'll need to build another facility with a stainless steel vacuum still. So we have a 1,500-litre vacuum still currently that we're running. Stainless steel was kind of really important so we could stop stripping out the copper with the pH level. Also, cleaning was a lot easier because we do distill the whole mash, opposed to making a wort like in whiskey.
You said that you had started working with koji as a chef, and it seems that that's how koji has been introduced in the United States as well. It's really been through culinary uses. So where did that discovery occur, and what was that journey like for you?
So we'll use in koji in a roundabout way. Obviously, it's the base for a lot of soy sauce, miso, and whatnot. And we'll use in soy sauce and misos to do a lot of curing. We then learned that we could use koji to fast-track the aging process with the enzymes on meat products, primarily half carcasses of cows. So then we had a real issue with sourcing enough koji to do this. So we started playing around and growing our own koji. We also thought we'd just be able to let it spawn, reuse, go again. What we've learned since that, or we learned quite quickly, that this isn't the best way and approach to do it, to keep the quality at a high level. So that was kind of the start of our journey into the rabbit hole of koji.
You said that you were quickly humbled when you realized you couldn't take those food applications and directly apply them to distillation. What was the challenge for you in making that transition? What's different about koji uses for food versus fermentations for alcohol?
The type of koji that we use in didn't produce citric acid, so we were adding some citric acid into the original ferments. We're also, in the process, our temperatures were far too low. So now we work up in the high 30s, obviously trying to keep it below 40 degrees Celsius. We come in a lot higher now with our humidity, and then drop the humidity quite rapidly down for the finishing process. So those early ferments really yielded kind of mushroomy flavors, quite bold, very, very savory, to the point that the distillate was interesting for the first sip, and then no longer interesting past that point. It was too much. So we kind of then had to go back and have a look at what we're doing, getting access to spores as well, different options to use. Really, at that stage, we were struggling to find any information on shochu production here in Australia. So it was really a learning curve on looking at kind of sake as the base pivot point, and then working out what changes we need to do there for shochu fermentation.
The koji that you were using originally would have been yellow koji, I presume.
Yes.
Which does not create natural acidity.
So we're using a hybrid, so brown koji, which is a hybrid of black. It's just a lot easier to use and cleaner. So it's a bit of a hybrid between white and black.
Okay. And so that does create acidity for you.
Yes.
Which solves that problem. But then that led to stripping your copper in your stills. Yes. And one of the things I love about these conversations with people who've had an independent journey of discovery is I learn something new. People would ask me why shochu makers were using stainless steel stills, and the most common response I'd get from makers and that I would give to people is that stainless stills are more reliable and they last longer. But now I know why.
Yes.
Because an acidic koji fermentation would be stripping those copper stills and, as you said, destroying the stills.
Yeah, and that's what you don't want to be doing with an expensive still.
Not at all. Now, that's primarily, or I guess exclusively, to the pot itself where the fermentation is sitting.
Yes.
So any of the copper up in the neck of the still would not necessarily be affected because it would just be distillate. It wouldn't be acidic.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
So you do get a little bit in the base of the hood, but we're not like up in the linalool and stuff is fine.
Right. There's a kind of a little bit of a hidden secret. There are a few shochu makers that put a little copper inside their stills.
We put we call it sacrificial copper in, and that's up in the hood just so it just gets some contact for sulfurs.
It's been interesting for me. I don't know if I have a blind spot for sulfur in shochu because I've been consuming it for so long, but very often when I introduce somebody who's an experienced spirits taster, when they try shochu for the first time, there's some sulfur there.
Yes.
And of course, we know why with the stainless stills and no copper contact. But most of that sulfur, I think, is removed through the polishing of the grains.
Yes. So we don't, we're talking about the grain. We use pearl barley, which is grown here in Victoria. It's a biodynamic product. We're really fortunate here in Australia. We buy all of our raw materials directly from the farm. But for our rice, it's only table polished rice. So I'm not sure what's happening in Japan, if it's similar to sake where the polishing is quite high. So our polishing is quite low. When I say low, in the way of the removal of the husk is primarily it.
Right.
So all of our rice comes out of the northern rivers. which is actually sown like barley. So it's not grown in rice paddies and flooded. We just don't have, I believe, the water resources in Australia to be doing that. So Max, an amazing farmer, so he just primarily relies on natural rainfall for his rice. And that gives us in the end product this really kind of grassy, aromatic rice, which is totally different to other rice that I've worked with. The variety is Tachimori. So it is a Japanese variety of rice. So I'd be really interested next time in Japan to see how in Japan traditionally the ferments are and the rice that they're using, how that yields on the flavor. But our ferments are very rich.
Typically, when you're using rice as the substrate for your koji in shochu production, it is table rice. It's typically food grade,
yes,
polished rice, so about 90% on the sake scale, right? As you said, low or less, right? It's confusing, but it's basically 10% of the grain's weight.
Yes, is removed.
Yeah, that's right. And that's really interesting. So you've got a dry rice cultivation using a Japanese strain of rice, and Japan's been using wet rice cultivation for a very long time. So that's fascinating. And it makes so much sense to fit to your local climate that you don't have the resources to do wet rice cultivation, which is obviously very water intensive.
Yes. Yeah, it's very water intensive. And we're really lucky. So these guys out there are primarily growing it for brown rice. So it was through another friend who's a co-founder of Melbourne Sake, Matt, who actually did the introductory for us and got that ball rolling to get these guys on board to help supply us and Melbourne Sake for rice.
Great. So you're using local barley and local rice, essentially.
Yes.
Australia grown grains.
The koji kin is imported, though. And currently for the shochu that you'll be tasting, hopefully in the next week or so, that's also 901 yeast. So it is a Japanese yeast.
I'm very excited to try it. Before we get into, I do want to definitely dive into your shochu production process and what you're doing for that. But when you began your distillery, it seems, I mean, from the little bit of reading I could do, we were introduced about 3 days ago, so we haven't had a lot of time to prepare for this episode. So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about Bright Victoria and what the region's like and what your process has been on that front?
Bright is about 4 hours outside of Melbourne. We're in the foothills of the ski resorts. So we're surrounded by Mount Buffalo, Mount Hotham and Falls Creek. It's a beautiful little valley. We have our own microclimate here, so it's quite lush and green, with a river running through the middle of it. A tiny population of 2,500 people, but we sleep anywhere from 30,000 plus. So on a long weekend, school holidays like it's currently in now, the place is just a hive of activity. Where it is amazing for us is it's cold. So we're coming now into the colder season, being autumn, and this means that the temperatures drop dramatically, which is ideal for running condensers off stills. Also for our fermentation, we don't need to use any glycol-assisted chilling for the ferments. And where our new factory is set up, it's actually right up against the hill with the state forest behind it. So we get no light for most of winter, which is dreadful for anyone else, but ideal for us as it doesn't get warm in there. So it is a beautiful little town, and we're really fortunate to be here. It kind of happens. That was a natural occurring thing that we just happened to be in Bright, and the path that we've gone down, just fortunate.
Are you originally from Bright, or did you relocate there?
I'm from near Byron Bay. It's the same Byron Bay, because it's probably most of your listeners know Byron Bay in Australia. From a little town called Kingscliff originally, so coastal town. I moved to Bright when I was 18 to work in the snowfields.
Not a lot of time in big cities, I guess, then.
No, not at all. I spent a couple of years in London, but that's about it for the big cities.
I've always lived in cities, and for me, there's a romance to this small town. I feel like it would be a really idyllic place to live, but I also worry that having spent my life in cities, I might get bored pretty quickly.
Yeah, we don't have any late night bars or such, but I grew up on a farm, on a biodynamic farm, which was close to the coast, but towns kind of surrounding, but you couldn't walk into the town. Whereas Bright, because we do have that huge influx of tourism, we have a lot of great eateries, bars, restaurants, far greater than you would see in a normal country town. So we're really fortunate.
As you began your distillery, what were your early products? What did you begin making right out of the gate?
So in 2016, our first release was an Australian dry gin, focusing on primarily local gin botanicals. The second product that rolled out quite closely after that was I like to call it a bastardized Mistel. Mistel being a French product, which is you take a neutral spirit and fortify fresh grape juice. We kind of bastardized it quite a bit by using two grapes, so Tempranillo and Frilliano, and then the base spirit that we fortify it with is a botanical spirit. So that was the second product, and then we've kept rolling from there. Where this region is also quite well known for, and the surrounding regions around us, for grape production. So it made sense that we're working with grapes. We also are surrounded by a lot of state forest and national parks, so we do have a lot of native Australian botanicals at our doorstep, which is amazing, and small farmers. So from there, then we released a gin called Neo, which is focusing on Japanese flavor profiles, but all from the northeast Victoria region. So we use yuzu, sencha green tea, and shiso. So the shiso we just grow. The sencha green tea is all grown in our valley, but exported straight to Japan as first harvest tea. And then the yuzu farm that we work with is Australian Yuzu Farm, which is the first, to my knowledge, is the first Australian commercial yuzu farm. So we're very fortunate to have these producers, you know, on our doorstep.
Oh, fantastic.
And then we kept banging out products, obviously. And that's when then I spent the better part of my time just focusing on shochu.
So you've been making shochu now for 6 years, is that right?
Not releasing. It's okay. A long story, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no worries.
So we're on our, so today I'm blending yuzu shu. So we're on our fourth year of yuzu shu production. That happened by default. Basically, we started amassing thousands of liters of shochu, and we needed a home for it. We worked really closely with the local yuzu farm, so it kind of made sense that we'd start to use that as a base for the for yuzu shu. The early days, a lot of our shochu is, it's kind of what Rachel and I love to consume. It's very, has a large mouthfeel, quite oily, very bold and robust in that honkaku style. But we knew that this product isn't what the Australian consumer is going to be looking for a first release especially. So we decided to put a lot of that aside into barrel, and then the rest of it we use in our yuzu shu production.
Okay. And when you started making shochu, your base was rice, is that right?
We actually started with barley. So I'm very sorry, this is long-winded.
Yeah.
When we started, once we kind of nailed in the koji, we weren't actually intending to make 100% shochu product. We wanted to make more of a hybrid product, which we released as our second product, which is a chili-based liqueur. So we're using koji and a traditional shochu fermentation, I suppose, with 100% barley. But then on day 20, we'd pitch in organic pilsner malt to stress the yeast out to also build a totally different ester profile. And at this time, we'll also, just to note, we're using beer yeast. So we tried a whole array of yeast. We couldn't actually get our hands on any of the Japanese yeast strains. White Labs were the only ones that were kind of selling small volumes. That was a journey in itself as well, because what we found are these beer yeasts that could only yield 8% alcohol in a beer, because of our 30-day fermentation process and the way that the koji slowly feeds the sugar to the yeast and the environment that it creates around it, we were punching out ferments at 15% alcohol. And even more excitingly at the time is we could use, say if you needed per hectolitre, 600 grams of yeast, we were getting down to like under 100 grams of yeast. So it was a whirlwind of kind of learning and discovery through this process. And that product, the chili koji, was actually, it's been a great domestic success for us, for our business. It was originally designed to be more a bartender's liquid for their toolkit, but it's really taken off for the direct-to-consumer. But now I'm really just primarily focusing on shochu.
With that chili liqueur, how are consumers drinking it? Are they mixing it, or are they on the rocks or soda?
Yeah, so a lot drink it on the rocks. It's more intended for things like a take on a dark and stormy.
Mm-hmm.
We have people that it's not my cup of tea, but they'll drink it with cola. It's also amazing with bitters.
Okay.
You can make anything from like a spiced version of an Americano along those lines. But a dark and stormy, so ginger beer, some lime, and the liqueur.
It sounds fascinating. I do like spicy cocktails, so.
Oh, I'll send a bottle over to you. But it's definitely not shochu, and it wasn't intended to be shochu. It was intended to be a koji-based spirit.
The folks at Horizon Distillery in Georgia we haven't had them on the show yet, but we intend to. They've been very careful with their rice koji spirit. They don't want to call it a shochu.
Yes.
Because they're sensitive to the fact that they're a couple of kids from Georgia making koji spirits very far from Japan.
Yeah. And this is something that Rachel and I have spent a lot of time discussing and being in depth about it. And I think it's also has probably slowed down our progress to going to market. So it's in the time frame, just being really cautious of making sure that we are being true to the genre, especially being the first in Australia to have done a commercial release, that we didn't want to bring something out that wasn't true to the cause. So we had to make it all 100%. We had to use good ingredients and do it in a nod to traditional format. But in saying that, our first release, we did choose to do vacuum distillation for our rice shochu. And that is more as an introductory for the Australian market and consumers. It's much more malleable in cocktails. It's still enjoyable just with soda or on the rocks. I drink it every night on the rocks. But when we're talking about as a cocktail base, it's much more approachable for a Negroni, a shochu martini, a lot of those kind of traditional cocktails that can be used into there.
Right. And most shochu in Japan is vacuum distilled. So you certainly are keeping with what's authentic here.
Yeah, it's just it's very aromatic, very gentle spirit. Rachel and I both prefer drinking atmospheric distilled products because it is much bolder. It has a lot more character to it. But I'm really, really happy and surprised at how malleable the rice shochu is in the bar. And we have a cocktail bar here as well. So it's kind of important that when we do make a product that we can use it, you know, throughout the bar, our restaurant, and in the tasting room.
It makes sense that as chefs, you would gravitate toward the more flavorful expression of shochu. But I agree with you. I think that vacuum distillation is a very nice entry point for many people who are unfamiliar with the category.
Yes.
No question. I'd really look forward to trying it.
Yeah, well, I hope you enjoy it. I know that you and Christopher's palate isn't kind of into the softer, gentler vacuum distilled shochus, but it'll be interesting to get your honest feedback on it. And then all of what we're finding with our barley atmosphere, the barley shochu, I should say, is atmospheric distillation. You know, we're really needing to age that product. This isn't so far with our mash bill. It's not something that you can just turn around in 6 months and go, you know, this is at its best, drink it. So we've actually decided not to bottle that until it is ready. So it's just a waiting game now to see when that time is.
One thing you could consider perhaps with your barley is if you could roast some of the mash bill, you might end up getting some really interesting chocolate coffee notes out of it without needing the barrel.
The earlier stuff went into barrel because it was so, you know, bold. The newer stuff is actually aged in stainless steel. And the future, we're hoping to get into earthenware as we go.
Oh, fantastic.
But the toasting of barley is something definitely we're investigating. And it kind of works into our mantra as well. Our restaurant that we run is 100% wood-fired. So it would work very well into the, you know, toasting the barley over the fire.
That sounds great. I know that the distillers who are using roasted barley here in Japan are sourcing it. They're not roasting their own.
Oh, they're like
that would give you an extra story.
I don't think I have the option to buy it.
Right. If anybody can do it, I imagine a couple of former chefs, now distillers, could figure that out.
We'll give it a go.
Very excited to try your products. Now, you said that your fermentations are about 30 days, and that's quite long. Are you doing the two-stage process? So your sort of starter fermentation with the koji,
yes,
and yeast and water, and then adding more of either rice or barley. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so with our barley, it's 100%. At the moment, it's 100% barley. So we grow the koji on a barley substrate. The rice is 100% rice, which makes sense. So, we do it a three-pitch stage. So we start off with a amount of koji, rice, and yeast with not a huge amount of water to get that process started. And then about day three, we do another pitch and then another pitch the day after that of koji and rice throughout those. So it's kind of over a three-day pitching timeline, if that makes sense.
I believe it does. So you're in your very first submerged fermentation, you're putting both koji inoculated rice and steamed rice at the same time. Is that right?
Yeah, a smaller amount of steamed rice. So of that first pitch, the lion's share is the koji.
Okay.
The inoculated rice. And then this pitch day two, we'll call it, because it isn't really on day two, but the second pitch is then a combination of additional koji and additional steamed rice, and then the same on the third.
That's fascinating. I've never heard of anybody making it that way, but it certainly would be compliant with what shochu is. It's an unusual way of doing it. It's taking a little bit of how sake is made, a little bit of how awamori is made, and a little bit of how shochu is made. So you're really touching on all the koji alcohol traditions here in Japan.
It's kind of just what seems to work for us. So that's what's working. It's kind of currently what we're doing. I don't know if in the future if we'll keep going that way, but I have at the moment no intention of changing that process.
When you're doing your koji propagation, what's the volume that you're making in a single batch?
Our small chamber that we use does about 60 kilos at a time. We've just commissioned for this brewing season, which we're just entering into now. So we've taken, in the next week, we're taking about 2 tons of yuzu to process, and then we'll take about 11 tons of rice in over the next 4 months. So the new room's capable of doing 300 kilos of koji at a time.
Okay, so you're increasing capacity by about fivefold.
Yeah, so the problem with the, and we'll see how it goes, the problem with the smaller chamber is that we're having to do so many rotations through it, which, as you know from growing koji, it demands a lot of time. Probably the best upgrade we did 2 years ago to our small koji cabinet was putting in just simple Inkbird thermometer and temperature controllers units. And this, so I can view it remotely on my mobile phone. Prior to that, I'd be going in at, say, 3 a.m, 4 a.m, going, oh, it should be here, going in and trying to assist it where needed. And sometimes you'd get out of bed and go in and go, oh, it's fine.
Right.
Or you'd go in and go, oh, stress levels, it's getting too hot. So that's probably been the most amazing thing that's happened to us in the distillery, is being able to remotely manage the or view what's happening in the koji room.
Sure, that's a tremendous lifestyle improvement, isn't it? Yeah, I remember being in New York at the Brooklyn Cura, and the head brewer and I went out for lunch nearby, and while we were at lunch, he pulled out his phone and he was checking his koji temperature and humidity to make sure everything is okay back home.
Yeah. So our new room, I think our new room's quite amazing. But everyone comes in, they want to talk about the stills. You know, we have big, shiny stills. They look amazing. But I think more money and time's actually gone into creating and building the koji room than anything else in the distillery.
In your koji inoculation period, you said that you drop humidity relatively quickly. Are you also varying temperature during that propagation period?
Yes, yeah, very much so. So when we're starting the process, we'll call it day one of steaming the rice, the koji room's sitting on about 90% humidity, which is extremely high. We're holding the rice or the barley as a complete unit for the first 12 hours. And that's staying at, say, a stable 27 degrees Celsius. From there, once that process is done, so we've inoculated in that time frame. Then when that's done, then we spread the koji out, the temperature of the room goes up. So we pull the temperature of the room up to about 37 to 38 degrees. At that stage, we bring the humidity down to about between 75 and 80, depends on what it's looking for like. And then this is where it really starts happening, and this is where we need to be really vigilant on it. And then we pretty much turn the humidity down to 40% once we get 24 hours into the process. And by that stage, the heater in the koji room is no longer required. We're now trying to bring in cooling air to try to bring the temperature of the koji down because it's so active. And then our job is pretty much to keep it at that stage below 40 degrees Celsius so it doesn't go into its reproductive cycle. That's it in a very simple kind of way, but yeah.
Sure. 27 is actually quite low for the beginning of a koji propagation.
Yeah.
But I do know that there are distillers here in Japan that are keeping their koji at lower temperatures to get different enzymatic activity,
yes,
for a different expression in their spirit. So that's interesting. I know at Yamato Zakura, where I've spent the lion's share of my time, the goal is usually when the koji, right after inoculation, it's going into the koji room. The goal is for it to be.
So are they inoculating at about 30 degrees?
Inoculation is actually happening at a higher temperature. The rice is cooled to below 40.
Yeah.
Before koji propagation.
Yes. Yeah. So we're similar. So we're. Yeah. We're definitely below 44, but we're sitting at between about 35 and 30 degrees Celsius for inoculation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a bit cooler. I think Tekkan would be panicking if his koji got that low temperature before he put it in the koji room.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I'll do a small batch and try to lift it up again. But yeah.
He's fifth generation. He's just doing it how his dad did it. Who's doing it how the distiller before him did it. You know, I don't know how much rhyme or reason there is to it other than tradition.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have any of the tradition, but on the upside, it just means we can be like the Wild Wild West and do what works, obviously. And once again, try not to bastardize the segment. Mm-hmm.
And are you distilling once in a pot still?
Yes. Yeah, definitely single pot distillation. Yep. So reading on basically in Japan, they're distilling the bulk of the spirit receival tank down to about 40% ABV. We do that for the barley. We don't do that for the rice. We're kind of finding that we're much happier with the finished product at about 50% alcohol.
Okay, interesting. I was just reading about an Awamori distillery that does similar. They distill down to 50% and then they dilute to 44% for storage. Just because of tax law here, they're not allowed to store at 50%.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But they're only distilling to that because they don't like what's in the tails. And Awamori obviously is made with rice, so that makes sense that you're having a similar experience.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're still just bulk storing. So we bulk store at the percentage it comes off the still, and then we tend to dilute down a month before bottling. So then we bring it down to currently 30% is where we're really happy with. We're finding with the, especially new into the Australian market, that 25% is probably just that little bit too low for our bartenders to kind of get a grasp of. Most of our other spirits sit at about 44%. And that just seems to be too high for the shochu because you really need to get some large dilution rate to get the spirit to then open up and stop being so kind of, I don't know the right word to use, tight.
Right.
Because you want it to really open up in your mouth and you get that kind of lovely feeling and expression. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the single pot distillation, you've got all that fatty acid and amino acid to to texture your mouth, and it's lovely. But you're right, the higher proof shochu can just be too tight, and water certainly helps. Your local water, is it generally soft water, or are you treating it in some way?
No, we're really fortunate. Again, we don't need to treat our water, so it's really soft. I suppose I don't want to say for most regional towns, but all of our water comes off the mountains, so it comes down and it comes in from the river system. We filter it for basically any microbes, for bacteria, but we don't need to do any adjustments past that.
Well, that's great. Yeah, and that probably aids with the mouthfeel as well if you've got nice soft water to work with.
And that's one of the amazing things with consuming shochu compared to other spirits is that lovely mouthfeel and the oiliness to it. Like you don't get that in many other just base spirits. Mm-hmm. You can get it with gins and whatnot because you're distilling over all those non-soluble oils in water, but are soluble in ethanol. So you get that lovely mouthfeel. But just from a grain spirit, single pot distilled, it's quite amazing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep, certainly. And 30% alcohol makes a lot of sense, I think. The 25% here in Japan is completely driven by tax. Mm-hmm. With our exploration, we found that 30 to 35% really tends to be the sweet spot for many different styles of shochu.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me. And are you thinking about using any other base ingredients? Are you going to move beyond rice and barley? Or are you happy with what you've got going and you just want to...
Definitely want to keep working on the barley side of it and keep perfecting that. The rice is, for our first introduction to the Australian market, I think it's getting close. It's pretty much there. So our goal is now, even this next brewing season, is volume of that rice product. Also working on RTDs. Now, RTDs aren't particularly my cup of tea. I'm not really into them. But we also need to get the shochu into consumers' hands. So it gives us a little bit more control over making sure that we're making a true can without all the BS in it, essentially. So just using real yuzu, if we're using yuzu, using real fruit, no preservatives. And it's entry for discovery is so much easier if you can just grab one can, open it. You don't need to know how to use it, how to mix it, opposed to buying a bottle of spirit. So that's currently all about, we've done a lot of R&D on that now. We're ready to scale and do the release. When we come to raw materials, we're really wanting to work also with buckwheat and potato. Potato will probably be last because as far as we can tell at the moment, we'll probably have to grow our own potato, which is in our long-term or our five-year plan, is to start growing potatoes.
Great.
That way we've got full control over getting them in off the paddock and getting them processed. But in saying that, we're not up to the stage of doing full production R&D on that at the moment.
I think you're right. The RTDs, are ready to drink cocktails, for people unfamiliar with the term, are certainly an excellent entryway. And if you can put an interesting spirit in there with high quality ingredients, you should have a delicious.
And that's also what with the stuff. So we've just done a pilot release 2 weeks ago of our first round into market, and the feedback's been great so far. But it's 100% shochu. And that was one of the things we'll see on the shelves here, is a lot of the products shochus, the least alcohol component, neutral spirit is the lion's share. So we kind of really want to batter down the shochu word and say, look, this is shochu with flavor, opposed to going, this is a vodka with a dabble of shochu.
Yeah. Virtually all canned chuhai or canned cocktails here in Japan are made with Korui shochu, which is essentially low-proof vodka. Mm-hmm. And the trend that I've seen recently is a lot of the cans will simply say vodka as the base spirit. And so the use of honkaku shochu or single-pot distilled shochu is actually quite uncommon, although it's now starting to appear. Some of the shochu makers have started to can typically just shochu soda. They're making canned highballs.
Yes.
But some of them are beginning to add either botanicals or fruit components as well. So that's just beginning here.
Yes.
So you're right on the leading edge.
Oh, there we go. So, and I understand from a commercial aspect why people lean towards using neutral grain spirit or neutral spirit, is the cost is dramatically less.
Of course.
You know, I don't know about in Japan, but I'm assuming the cost will be not too dissimilar to Australia. Is producing quality shochu is expensive.
It is.
The raw materials are expensive. The process is expensive. So, but I think to do it justice, we need to keep it to 100% shochu.
I respect that. I wholly agree. And generally, pot distilled spirit costs more than column distilled spirit or neutral grain spirit, right? That's just,
yes.
It's just costs more to produce. And as you said, the mash bill is more expensive and the yields are lower and everything, right? But you should drink, I mean, drinking should be a pleasure. And I find it much more pleasurable when you're drinking something that's made with care.
Yes.
Than something that was made in a 7-story column still.
Yeah, so do I. Especially as I get older, it's about, you know, drinking the finer things and the nicer things and less of it.
That's right. That's right. So I guess you're in quite a unique position, being a distiller in Australia making shochu. And my understanding is that shochu to this point has not been particularly broadly available or embraced among Australian drinkers. And so what is it like there on the ground now? And do you see growth or do you see opportunity?
Oh, I hope I see opportunity. Rachel and myself, I feel comfortable speaking on Rachel's behalf, but we've been in business for so long, but we're so dreadful at it. We've been successful with business. I don't know how or why, but we've been very fortunate on that front. We always start with what we want to make. And that's been in the restaurant game to, we do what we want to make. We serve it the way we want to serve it. And we've definitely done that in the alcohol production side as well. So we set out on this journey without a sales plan. We've never had a sales plan for any of our products. It's always been a very natural evolving thing. And for some reason, people buy it. And I'm very grateful to them for buying and supporting us, but I have no real idea of how that happens. With this next stage of our journey, we realize it's going to be harder. As you said, like shochu isn't widely recognized here, but we have so many people that love Japan. We have so many people that travel to Japan for cultural experiences, for snow experiences and whatnot. And our bartenders in Australia are really out there looking for new frontiers. They're wanting new flavors in their cocktails. We do have an amazing bar culture here for high-end cocktails. You know, we have a long history of having, you know, high consumption of cheap, nasty alcohol, but that's rapidly changing. So I think with all of this happening, I do see a really bright light for shochu in Australia. It's just at this point about getting in front of the right bartenders, getting the message through into the right retailers, and moving forward from there. And it is such a it's such a incredible spirit to drink. And I'm not just saying that because we produce it, but I'm saying that because I really honestly love drinking it. It's so versatile. And there's not many other beverages out there that are that versatile. I think the light for shochu in Australia is going to be bright.
That's great to hear. Of course, as a former chef, you appreciate shochu for what it is. And that's been my experience is long before shochu began gaining traction in bars and among consumers in the United States, I would talk to chefs and they'd be like, oh, I love shochu. That's what I drink at home or what I drink when I'm off work, but I can't sell it.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what it is. Nobody wants to drink it. But so many chefs, I think, really understand and appreciate the flavors and the complexity of the spirit in a way that most consumers aren't yet aware of. But hopefully that'll change globally over the next few years.
Yeah, hopefully. And we've seen it here in Australia with sake primarily. Like when we started selling sake in our earlier restaurants, we really struggled to move it. We struggled to move good quality sake. A lot of people just come in and think it's, you know, heat it up, have a shot. And you'll be going, oh no, this whole other realm. Matt, who is black market sake, really changed the playing field. He started importing amazing sake from very young sake down to aged. And that's really changed people's perception here in Australia of quality beverages. So I'm hoping that'll be the next step for us as well of going, you know, you can get your head around this, but there's, you know, shochu also exists. It's amazing how many people come into the distillery or the tasting room and they say, oh, it's sake. And you go, no, it's not sake. It's like a cousin of sake. It's and I also really enjoy sharing that with people because I don't believe there's many new things out there in the world that you can still discover and you can taste, and it has a raft of heritage behind it. It's not some flash in the pan new product. Japan has been producing this stuff forever,
right?
But we're just so slow in the Western world to kind of get our heads around it.
That's right. It's no question the long history and tradition is very deep and rich here, and yet Western governments don't even recognize it as a spirits category when it's older than gin. It's older than Caribbean rum, let's say.
Yeah.
There's evidence that rum was being made in India a long, long time ago.
Mm.
You're right. It's just, it's undiscovered. And I think how many more major spirits categories are left to discover? I think very few globally.
No, I agree. Yeah. And this is also what makes it exciting. Like it has everything going for it. But if we look at like tequila and mezcal, I think not very much is consumed in country. And then we look at shochu and it's like the polar opposite.
That's right.
So it's an exciting time.
Absolutely. And I'm very glad that you're taking the plunge at Reading Company Distillery to try to lead that charge in Australia. So when you began production of shochu beyond your tests, when you began to go into commercial production, what kind of yields were you getting from each batch?
So we're pulling off at about 230 liters of spirit at 30% after we dilute it down. Currently, we don't bottle one batch per run. We blend all those runs in. So we tend to do, say if we have 10,000 liters of ferment going at any given time, we distill that through, which is 10 runs through the still, and that goes into one storage tank for aging.
Okay, I see. And then you've now built a new production facility, and what do you anticipate your yields might be?
Yeah, so our yields essentially will be the same. Our stills are 1,000-liter pot still, so they're still the same. The difference is now is the volume of fermentation that we can do.
Okay.
So we're looking over the next 4 months, we'll process 11 tons of rice, which is, without having a spreadsheet in front of me, it's about, if we do 8 tons, so we're looking at about 8 tons of rice should be about 16,000 liters of ferment.
Okay.
Which is still, look, we're a very small distillery operation. We're just Rachel and I own the business. But when we come to shochu, we're the largest in Australia.
Sure. It's good to be number one in something.
Yeah. So we are small, but our yields will grow. And that's the idea. So we'll see what happens in the future.
I certainly hope that I have an opportunity to visit Australia and make my way out to Bright to visit. And sounds like an amazing place. And your distillery would be fantastic to visit. And of course, love to eat in your restaurant and drink some of your cocktails as well.
do come out, because we can house you here. It's a great part of the world. And, you know, if we could tee it up with doing something in Melbourne about an educational piece on Shochu, it would be really exciting.
That would be fantastic. Hopefully we can get something arranged, start to put those pieces together and maybe get myself and or Christopher down there at some point.
Yeah.
Hamish, thank you so much for being on Japan Distilled.
Thank you so much for your time and having me on here. It's it's been amazing. And just drink more shochu.
That's the message I was hoping to hear.
Good shochu.
That's right. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank all of you for listening to Japan Distilled. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you'd like more information on Reed & Company Distillery, please check the show notes on japandistilled.com. If you have any questions for me, please reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram at Japan Distilled. And where can people find you? Are you on social media at all?
In a very bad way, I'm on social media. The Reed & Co. Distillery on Instagram is a great place to find us. And then I've also have a new account, which is Koji Spirits on Instagram.
That's a great handle to get. I'm a little bit jealous.
I need to actually start using it though.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Distilled podcast. This has been Christopher Pellegrini with my co-host, Stephen Lyman. Our theme song is Begin Anywhere by the very talented Tomoko Miyata. Audio engineering by the incomparable Rich Pav, who also edits the fantastic Uncanny Japan podcast with Teresa Matsuura. Please give that a listen as well if you're interested in Japanese fables and ghost stories.